From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're hearing incredible stories out of Las Vegas of heroism during the massacre there. 53-year-old Mike Magari is being lauded by the White House for laying across young concertgoers to protect them. He spoke with KYW in Philadelphia, where he lives.
I just dove on top of like 14 people, pulled a chair over them or a table. Said, I'm a lot older than you guys, so tried to lighten up the moment a little bit. And anybody would have done the same thing. Listen, we're all just people. We're trying to help other people, and I don't think I did anything spectacular.
He later elaborated, older than them, meaning that they were younger and should live. We're also learning more about the Arsenal shooting suspect Stephen Paddock brought into his hotel suite. 23 legally purchased guns, more than 10 bags full. Explosives were found in his home. Reporter Brian Mann is in Las Vegas for NPR. Brian, start, though, with, you know, the victims, 59 victims we're learning more about, acts of heroism. What are you hearing?
Yeah, this is really wrenching. I mean, you know, we've been hearing about these high school sweethearts, Bobby and Jessica Parks. She died. He survived. She was a kindergarten teacher in Palmdale, California, and her husband also seriously injured. They have two children. You know, this was a family event. You know, Dana Gardner, a mom from San Bernardino, was killed while attending this concert with her. Just a lot of broken lives here right now.
Yeah. And the heroes, a 30-year-old copy machine repairman from California who was shot but still rescued around 30 people.
Yeah, that's right. Jonathan Smith talked to the Washington Post about this, about helping families escape, and he was actually hit in the neck by a bullet. In press conferences, the sheriff's department here has said people helped each other, creating these impromptu medic stations. Sometimes the first responders had to sort of shoo civilians away. And I think it is important, Robin, to remember there was one shooter here. That's horrible. But there were also 22,000 amazing people at this concert, people who helped each other with courage and compassion. It's a big part of the story now.
Yeah. But speaking of the shooter, we heard of his arsenal. He also reportedly had legal bump stock devices. These can convert a single trigger pull gun, you know, fires one shell at a time, to a gun that can automatically fire like a machine gun with one trigger pull, making this perhaps the first mass shooting in U.S. history with an automatic weapon. Now, Las Vegas is a place people go to fire automatic weapons. There's a place, Battlefield Las Vegas, on the Strip. They offer the ultimate adrenaline rush, 4,000 rounds a minute. What are people there saying about these reports of maybe the first automatic weapon attack?
Well, I think people here do think that this has raised the stakes. And, you know, Robin, as I was traveling out here to cover this story, I saw on magazine racks in airports, Gun and Ammo magazine, you know, the gun culture magazines, they all have these military-style weapons now and these bump stock-type devices you talked about that can modify these firearms. You can buy them online. And so I do think there are new questions being asked about this element of gun culture, this part of this hobby that has become so popular. You know, we now have those horrible recorded sounds of what sounds like a war zone in the middle of Las Vegas. And I do think now people are going to say, why is that part of the culture? Why have gun enthusiasts embraced that so passionately?
Yeah, well, one tweet that I noticed, Caleb Keeter, who's the lead guitarist for the Josh Abbott Band, they played before Jason Aldean. They had to hide from the gunfire. He tweeted out, I've been a proponent of the Second Amendment my entire life until the events of last night. I can't express how wrong I was. We actually have members of our crew with legal firearms. They were useless. So that conversation has started there. But just in the minute we have, Brian, what more do we know about explosive materials found on Paddock's car or in his home?
Yeah, there's a lot of investigation still to be done here. But, you know, investigators used a robot to go into his home. They reportedly found an explosive material called tannerite that gun enthusiasts sometimes use to make their shooting targets explode. And they may have also found ammonium nitrate. This is one of the materials used in the Oklahoma City bombing. And one other thing that's intriguing here that we'll be following is they say they found electronic devices, which authorities are still trying to identify. No word yet on what all of that arsenal adds up to.
No. And motive. Any motive?
Yeah, motive is a huge question here. We just don't know. He spent a lot of time and money, a lot of effort and horrible effort preparing for this attack, allegedly, including modifying these weapons. Why? We don't know. And so far, that's the huge missing puzzle piece.
NPR's Brian Mann in Las Vegas. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, as we continue to follow the news from Las Vegas, we're also following other news, including the Nobel Prize in Physics, which was awarded today to three physicists for their contributions to the LIGO detector and the observation of gravitational waves. The winners, Rainer Weiss from MIT and Kip Thorne and Barry Barish from Caltech. Joining us now is Gabriela Gonzalez, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at Louisiana State University and part of the LIGO collaboration. Gabriela, welcome back to Here and Now, and this must be a very exciting day for you.
It is a very happy day for all of us in the LIGO team.
And this issue, gravitational waves, is something that has been in the news so much I feel like I'm an expert on it at this point. But remind our listeners what gravitational waves are.
Gravitational waves were predicted by Einstein's theory of gravity, saying that when masses move, like two black holes orbiting around each other, they distort the space-time in a wave fashion. So they emit these gravitational waves, which are waves of space-time. It sounds mysterious, but it can be measured by measuring distances very, very precisely, which is what we do here on Earth.
And what we do here on Earth involves what you're doing, which is LIGO. These are laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories. And that's one in the West Coast and one down in Louisiana, correct?
That's right. We have one here in Livingston, Louisiana, very close to LSU, where I teach and work. And the other one in the Northwest, in the state of Washington, in Hanford.
So what have those detectors detected so far?
Well, the first detection was gravitational waves that had been originated by two black holes. I like saying that they were dancing a tango and ending in an embrace. And that happened 1.3 billion years ago. That time was the time that the gravitational waves took to travel the distance to Earth and go through Earth. But since then, we have detected also three other gravitational waves also from other systems of pairs of black holes that merged and formed a larger black hole. And the last one, I think it's the most exciting one because it was not only detected by the two LIGO detectors in the US, but also by a sister detector in Europe. So finally, we could triangulate to know where the source, where these black holes were, with much better precision than ever before.
And what does that help us do? What does that tell us about the universe to have all this information?
Oh, we are just learning so much. We didn't know that black holes existed in pairs, for example. We knew about black holes because sometimes they are close to other stars that emit X-rays. So we can tell that there is a black hole there because of what other stars do nearby. But if you have two black holes, then there is no light. But there are gravitational waves. So now we could tell that these black holes existed in pairs, but also that they were quite a bit larger than all the ones we had seen in X-rays. So we are learning a lot of new things.
So what were the contributions of these three scientists who have just been awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics? Rainer Weiss from MIT, Kip Thorne, and Barry Barish from Caltech.
Ray Weiss was the one who in the 70s thought about using interferometers, lasers on long scales, on kilometer scale, to detect gravitational waves. It sounded impossible, but he calculated what noises could affect the experiment, and he thought it was possible. Kip Thorne was one of the first people that was convinced by this argument and made sure that Caltech as an institution collaborated with MIT to start this LIGO project also in the 70s. This is almost 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And Barry Barish, later on, when the project was in a bit of trouble, getting everything in place, he took charge of administering, leading the project at Caltech and MIT and put it on track. And also he encouraged the community outside Caltech and MIT to form a collaboration to contribute to the development of technology and the analysis of data. And that was created in 1997.
So we've had 2 days so far of Nobel Prizes, and every single winner, all six of them, are Americans. What does that tell you?
Well, America is still a leader in technology, in science. But I have to say that depends a lot on the education of the new generation. And there have been some problems detected that the new generations are not as educated or as interested in science as in the past. So I'm hoping that will change.
That's Gabriela Gonzalez, who is the spokesperson for the LIGO Scientific Collaboration and is a professor of physics and astronomy at Louisiana State University. Gabriela, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was a pleasure.
Academy Award-winning director Francis Ford Coppola has been acclaimed for movies like The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. Now he's turned his attention to a new way of making films. It's called live cinema. Coppola has been exploring it through workshops and the new book, Live Cinema and Its Techniques. Francis Ford Coppola joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with the question, what is live cinema in your view?
Live cinema is essentially a cinematic piece of work, we'll call it a film or a motion picture, with its unique way of telling a story, and yet is not shot conventionally and then months and months gone by in editing, but is actually made while it's happening, and you're seeing it as it's being acted and being edited and being presented. Music is being added. It's all a live experience.
Would the end result, though, of live cinema be something that looks like a movie? Would you be able to tell, if you're a viewer, the difference between live cinema and not live cinema?
Well, since it really isn't being practiced quite today, it's hard to say because there are a few examples. It certainly wouldn't look like what we now call live television. There's been a number of live television productions. There was The Sound of Music and
right.
Peter Pan and Grease. But, you know, anyone who turns on a television and suddenly you're watching a movie knows instantly the difference between what is a movie and what is television or live television. So you could say that live cinema, if you suddenly just got it and looked at it, it would look like a movie. And whether or not you would notice that it was being performed live would depend somewhat on the power of the performance of the show. And because basically, live cinema is going back to the old tradition of performance, which is not present in modern cinema. Modern cinema is canned, as is most of our entertainment.
And there's something exciting about live.
Absolutely. I mean, I think back to the days of the 19th century when there were the equivalent of a movie director, except it was the director of the Dresden Opera or some opera company in Europe. And this person had tremendous power and resources to put on a production. And the difference is that when they had worked and were ready to present it to the public, he or the conductor, which was very often the same person, got up before the audience and they did it. And that audience was electrified at seeing Aida for the first time, or La Traviata, or the Flying Dutchman, or whatever it was. So that there was the element of performance. Performance is the thrill of knowing that what's being done is being done while you're watching it and could go wrong.
Well, and you point out a lot of the problems with live cinema, or at least a lot of the challenges with live cinema, including hiding all of the cameras.
Well, that's one of the first things. And of course, the piece, the book, and what have you is really a manual of I didn't write it to be a book. I wrote it down to remember all the things I had learned in trying to do this type of work. And many of the things that I talk about, I meant it to be helpful to other directors who might want to venture into this. You know, in the last 8-9 years, the cinema has gone from being a mechanical medium, photochemical with film and editing and actually holding the film in your hand and gluing it to another piece of film. It has gone to be a wholly electronic form, digital electronic form, so that movies today are made in a totally different process than they used to have been made throughout our history of cinema, going back to the turn of the century. So my position was, well, gee, if it's being made in a totally different way, in a totally different method, then perhaps the films will by themselves be very different than they ever could be before. And I began to wonder, well, how will they be different, you know? And that's what made me sit down and want to do this experiment. But all my life, since I was a little kid and first saw television when I was about 6 years old, I was fascinated with the idea of distant vision, being able to see at a distance.
You say you'd love to try live cinema techniques with a film like Lawrence of Arabia, which I couldn't think of a more difficult one to do. But why do you say that?
No, I didn't say I wanted to do that. I said that if they asked me, you know, obviously to make 12 Angry Men, which is jurors discussing a case, is the unity that makes live television easy. But live cinema isn't limited in that way. You could tackle something much more ambitious cinematographically, which the great pioneer John Frankenheimer did. John Frankenheimer's live television productions from the 50s were like movies. They were brilliant and they were ambitious and they were shot-based, which is one of the differences between cinema and live television, is that cinema tells itself through a succession of very specific shots, whereas television, usually the shots are what we call coverage. They're just basically a shot of the group and a shot of this person and that person, rather than a dynamic storytelling through beautifully composed shots.
One of the things you say in your book is that a shot can be a word, but it's better if it's a sentence. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it could be a word, and let's say it's a shot of a courthouse, a court building, and that shot then says the courthouse. But it could be a shot of the courthouse with the shadow of a person hanging from a tree, and then it's a sentence, the courthouse where justice sometimes is miscarried. Or the shot can move and tell different elements. So the shot is an expression of ideas, and they could be as simple as just a word, or it could be a whole part of the story.
How difficult do you think it would be to do live cinema when it comes to the actors?
That's the easiest part. That was one of the things that I dwell on. And it's funny because, you know, everyone knows that, oh, in movies that sometimes it's tough to get the actor to get through their page and a half of dialogue, and they have to have lines pasted up on the walls and stuff. But bottom line, actors, if they're given the chance to properly rehearse, and by that I don't mean just repeating the text over and over again. I think one of the more interesting chapters or useful chapters is the one about preparing the actors. But actors are no issue at all in terms of being able to do the entire piece from memory.
In the midst of all this conversation about the future of cinema, I wonder what you think about whether television has replaced cinema in a way right now, that you might be better off watching some incredible television show than spending $20 to go to the movies.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, what happened was that 10, 15 years ago, a lot of the young filmmakers who had been so inspired by the movies that people of my generation made in the 70s wanted to do that kind of cinema, but it was, as always, very hard to get to do it. So what was offered to them as an option was to do television, and in fact, series television. And they grasped that opportunity, and work like The Sopranos or Breaking Bad was done, very much inspired by cinema of the 70s, but they applied it to the form of modern television. So modern television today is extremely rich and ambitious and has greatness to it.
Would you like to be involved?
No. Could I do it live? Yes. If I could do it live, I would want to be involved.
And by the way, you are joining us from San Francisco. Why have you not based yourself in Hollywood?
Well, when I was a young screenwriter and wanting to be a director, I did live in Los Angeles. And I was one of the first film student graduates who got an opportunity first as a screenwriter and then as a director, where I met other young film students like George Lucas and John Milius and Carol Ballard and all of the colleagues from UCLA and USC. But we didn't feel exactly that we fit in with the studio system. And we wanted to, you know, explore making more, it's always difficult to give a word for, but more personal films, more experimental films, more films like the films that were coming from Europe and with the New Wave or the great Italian films. Also, we were more adept at using very lightweight equipment and more handheld cameras that you could put everything you needed to make a movie into a small van, which we did and made a film actually on the road. And we all said, well, gee, why don't, we can make movies anywhere. Why don't we go to a more exciting city in terms of traditions of literature and poetry? And so we chose San Francisco, which is also not all that far from L.A. in terms of needing actors or the other resources.
So reading this book, I learned a couple of things. First and foremost, that radio production, which I've been doing for a long, long time, is very different than film, as I listen to you talk about some of the challenges that you would have. But also, we learn why your name is Francis Ford Coppola. You were following your brother.
Exactly. I had a wonderfully brilliant and 5 year older brother who wanted to be a novelist, so I immediately said, well, I'll be a playwright. And it was always my dream that we would be two famous brothers like Aldous Huxley and his brother William James and Henry James, or Heinrich and Thomas Mann, he wrote under the name August Floyd Coppola, so I just imitated him and I became Francis Ford Coppola. I was named Ford after the Henry Ford Hospital where I was born. And so, yes, it's true that I was imitating his use of the three names. I thought that was so cool.
That's Academy Award-winning director Francis Ford Coppola, whose new book about a new way to shoot films is called Live Cinema and Its Techniques. Francis Ford Coppola, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
President Trump is in Puerto Rico. He spoke at a roundtable with local officials, although he reportedly did not respond to a comment from the San Juan mayor that this is not about politics. He did speak with and sit next to the island's governor.
Governor, I just want to tell you that right from the beginning, this governor did not play politics. He didn't play it at all. He was saying it like it was, and he was giving us the highest grades. And I want to, on behalf of our country, I want to thank you.
With that, he shook his hand. NPR's Merritt Kennedy is in San Juan. Merritt, before the president arrived, the governor held a news conference of his own. What did he say?
So Governor Ricardo Rocio Nevarez was saying that he really hopes that the president is able to see the extent of the damage. And he says that just by flying over the island, that will be almost unavoidable. And the governor added that they're working on an aid proposal for the storm, and he hopes that the funding the U.S. territory receives will be consistent with the damage, as it would be in Florida or in Texas.
Well, and the governor's walking a tricky line here because he has been effusive about President Trump while also trying to get across the message that the aid is much needed. One of his colleagues, the mayor of San Juan, has been in a spat with President Trump over the amount of time it's taken for the aid to come. Did the governor allude to that at all? Or
no, he didn't reference that debate specifically, saying that he plans to have a storm-centric conversation with the president. But it certainly will be interesting to see what comes out of the president's meeting. We're hearing that they're planning to meet. What comes out of that meeting with San Juan's mayor?
Yeah. And what are the people of the island saying? Are they, I mean, there's no communication in parts of the island. Are they aware the president is coming? Are they aware of the criticism over the amount of time that it's taken for the aid to get there? What are they saying to you?
Actually, that's exactly right, Robin. Many people that I've spoken with had not been aware that the president was planning to visit. And, you know, any reaction that I've gotten from the things that Trump has been saying in particularly hard-hit areas has been after reading people his tweets off my phone.
And what do they say?
I had a conversation with a man in the central Florida area of the country, and I read him the one where Trump said that Puerto Rican leaders want everything handed to them when it should be a community effort. And what he told me was that at that point, it had been completely a community effort. And it's worth noting that FEMA has come since then.
Yeah. Well, at this press conference today, it was a joint press conference with FEMA officials. What are they saying about the latest in aid?
So they're saying that it is getting out, and they are trying to set up a system where every municipality will have a single area where people can go to pick up food, water. They're trying to streamline the process after receiving criticism on the logistics of the aid distribution.
Yeah. NPR's Merritt Kennedy in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Merritt, thank you.
Thank you.
Machine Guns Vegas is a shooting range in Las Vegas that advertises the real feel of what it's like to clear a room with just the pull of a trigger. But now that many more people know what that really feels and sounds like, there are questions again about automatic weapons. Congressman Adam Schiff told Morning Edition the FBI told him that gunman Stephen Paddock had fully automatic weapons. That means you hold the trigger down and unload dozens of rounds, as opposed to a semi-automatic weapon, which might automatically load bullets from a magazine, but you have to pull the trigger to fire each one. The AP and the New York Times report that Paddock also had two bump stocks, kits that can be used to turn semi-automatics into automatic weapons, which would make Sunday night's massacre the first mass shooting in U.S. history carried out with automatic weapons. Paul Barrett is deputy director at the Stern Center for Business and Human Rights at New York University. He's also the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Paul, when you heard the recordings of the shots being fired Sunday night, 90 shots in 10 seconds by one accounting, did you, like others, assume it was automatic?
Yes, I assumed immediately that it was either an automatic weapon or an AR-15-style weapon that had been customized.
Okay, well, look, we want to hasten to say that, as many say, including the sheriff in Las Vegas, this hasn't been studied by the ATF yet. We only have these anonymous reports from inside the hotel room. But if this was an automatic weapon, let's go through this. Explain the legality of automatic weapons.
They were basically made illegal, and we're talking about machine guns, to use a more common term, mm-hmm. in 1986. But when that happened and the very severe restrictions were put on acquiring a new post-1986 machine gun, the machine guns that were already in private hands were basically grandfathered in. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands of those firearms in the country and available to be bought with some restrictions on the transaction. And a lot of collectors like to have a fully automatic machine gun in their collection. And a lot of people like to go out to the range and experience that automatic weapon firing phenomenon, which is, you know, quite awe-inspiring if you've never had the experience of putting that many rounds downrange that quickly.
Well, but that desire to have these guns has made them hard to get a hold of, these grandfathered, legally purchased automatic weapons made before 1986. Have these weapons been made after 1986, just to be clear?
Oh, sure. They're made, but their uses are sharply restricted. I mean, law enforcement can acquire a fully automatic weapon. Obviously, the military acquires thousands of them every year.
Right. But the average gun owner can't get or shouldn't be able to get an automatic weapon made after 1986 because they are illegal.
For almost all practical purposes,
right.
That's correct.
And by the way, how are we, and this may just be semantics, but how are these automatic weapons, again, single trigger pull, lots of bullets can come out, how are they distinguished from assault rifles?
Well, assault rifle is actually a very vague term and has been used historically to describe both fully automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons, which you accurately said a few minutes ago, fired one round for each trigger pull. So I would set assault weapon to one side and stick to semi-automatic versus fully automatic.
Okay, let's do that then.
Yeah.
So now we come to how these semi-automatic rifles can be made to be automatic rifles. And there's a distinction here as well. The Washington Post is reporting that investigators are still trying to figure out if the shooter, Stephen Paddock, modified an AK-47 that was found with mechanical components to make it fully automatic, which is illegal, or if he used a legal modification called an attachable crank. And we also talked about how these bump kits were found. What are the differences between these different ways you can modify a semi-automatic and make it automatic?
The essential difference is going into the guts of the gun and mechanically changing the fire mechanism so that the gun becomes fully automatic. Depress the trigger and rounds come out of the barrel until you release the trigger, versus buying basically a modification kit that from the exterior can be attached to the gun and will help you keep the trigger depressed repeatedly so that a semi-automatic gun becomes a fully automatic gun. And there are two basic kinds of sort of aftermarket devices you can buy. One is called a trigger crank, which when it's attached, you can crank the device like a music box crank, and that just keeps depressing the trigger at a very rapid rate. Or the one you mentioned, the bump or slide fire, which allows for the shooter to harness the recoil of the firearm and keep shooting at a very rapid rate that approaches that of a fully automatic weapon.
But so this is external, as you said. Why is the external modification legal, but going into a gun and changing the mechanics of it is not?
I don't have any rational explanation for the distinction, and it seems to me that devices that make semi-automatic rifles fire like automatic rifles ought to be illegal.
Well, and we hear that, and you just said that this is a thrilling thing for a gun enthusiast to be able to go to a firing range, for instance, to target practice, and to be able to pull the trigger once and have this barrage of bullets come out. And we understand that this is, you know, it's these gun enthusiasts who are keeping this from being made illegal.
Well, as a practical matter, I think that's true. It's gun enthusiasts who ultimately support the NRA, and it's the NRA and its many local affiliates around the country that make it so difficult to pass federal gun legislation. But I am personally not aware of there ever having been a lot of legislative attention to these devices, and maybe the Las Vegas massacre will cause some attention to be focused on them.
Well, in the meantime, there are other aspects of this horrendous massacre that people who, you know, study guns are pointing to that are hugely different. So let's take, you know, if these were automatic weapons, and it seems as if they were, what does that say to you?
It is a sort of an additional breathtaking aspect of this uniquely American phenomenon of the periodic mass shooting. And it is very disheartening. And at the same time, I would worry about whether we're used to it and somewhat jaded, and people are talking about it and feeling bad about it today and tomorrow. But what about next week and next month and next year? And these things tend to fade from memory relatively quickly.
Well, people are pointing to the infamous Texas Tower attack, Charles Whitman, 1966, you know, climbed up into a tower. Same kind of thing. He had height. He had guns. He killed 17, wounded 30. One could presume that if he had had an automatic weapon, that toll would be much higher. But he also had the height. Your thoughts on how that changes everything, too, the fact that this shooter in Las Vegas was 32 floors up.
Yeah. I think it will call into question many public events that resemble this country music concert if they are adjacent to skyscraper buildings. I think the security people will think twice about how vulnerable the attendees at the event will be, because so much security attention at mass events has been focused on enlarging the periphery around the event so that people can be checked for weapons at a distance from where the festivities are taking place. But now you've got a whole new phenomenon of, as you say, someone potentially firing at great height. And we are reminded that using either semi-automatic military-style weapons or fully automatic weapons, that the distance, which I think has been estimated at some 400 yards, 300, 400 yards, is not a barrier to hitting people particularly when they're grouped so closely together.
Well, James Allen Fox, the Northeastern University criminologist, tells the Washington Post, not just those things you mentioned, this ability to fire from a distance, to fire from above, which, you know, enabled him to target people. But also, if he had been on the ground, he would have been taken out much sooner, probably had double the time to be able to shoot.
I think that's a very fair point.
Paul Barrett, his book is Glock, The Rise of America's Guns. We've spoken to him before about gun issues. He's deputy director of the Stern Center for Business and Human Rights at NYU. Paul, thank you.
You bet.
And we mentioned the Machine Gun Vegas shooting range. They closed yesterday and today because of the shooting and issued this statement. We believe, as we always have, that there should absolutely be more stringent control of the types of firearms private individuals can own. There's no doubt that the shooter's ability to inflict so many casualties was heavily due to weapons he had access to. That's the Machine Gun Vegas shooting range. And we want to end the hour with yesterday's vigils in Las Vegas, one of them on the steps of City Hall. KQED's Stephen Cuevas was there.
Pastor Paul Gallet joined city and state leaders, other clergy, and hundreds of other Las Vegans. He summoned the raw emotion of the day.
Dear God, we just cry out to you for our city. We cry out, God, that you'll do something amazing and touch these broken lives, that we pray this.
God, you are higher than any other.
The evening filled with song from members of Victory Outreach Youth Ministry, lifting their voices for the victims whose names we are just learning. At least half a dozen of those killed came from Southern California.
Los Angeles is not far from here. San Diego is not far.
Pastor Pascual Urabazo spent all day at the convention center trying to help locals and out-of-towners connect with missing loved ones.
We left our team there, and they're going to be
in the convention center.
Yeah, and they're there right now because there's another wave of family members coming in, and we're going to be there to help them and whatever they need.
Moving in and around the Las Vegas Strip, it would be hard to know anything was amiss if you didn't know. The Strip was still ablaze in flashing lights, though some casinos had dimmed their glow.
There are people here from all over the world, and they come here for the entertainment.
68-year-old James Katzen wore an orange T-shirt that read, "Enough Gun Violence." He recently campaigned to tighten background checks for Nevada gun purchasers. Today, though, he simply wanted to join those grieving for the hundreds murdered, wounded, and traumatized.
And I'm sorry that they'll be going home, and this will be their only memory of Las Vegas, because I love this town, but we definitely need to do something about it never happening again.
That's resident James Katzen ending that report from KQED's Stephen Cuevas.